Well, it was back in 1910, on this very day, that Lee DeForest, pioneer in radio, arranged what is now often referred to as the first radio broadcast. This was something that happened in New York City. He broadcast the voice of Enrico Caruso to some receiving locations around the city. People had to listen to it with headphones. The potential audience was rather limited, but it was considered to be the first broadcast to reach the public. Of course, it would be a number of years before the first regularly scheduled broadcast. Well, we thought that, as this was in some respects the birth of radio this day, January 13th, would be interesting to talk a little bit about the early days of radio and perhaps also something about where we are now and where we're going. And we thought we would ask our own general manager, Don Mullally, to come and spend some time with us this morning. He's director of the Division of Broadcasting, WYLAM-FM-TV, and as something that's someone who's been not only involved in radio, but a student of radio and the history of radio for a long time. And I know that there are probably people still who will remember fondly a radio series that he did on this station quite a long time ago, where he would play old radio programs. He's brought along a few clips that we will play here this morning. They're old commercials, which we thought might interest and entertain you. And of course, as we talk, your questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, David. You know, I'm one of those people who's blessed with having a hobby and a job that intersect very closely. I have for years been collecting old radio programs and especially old commercials and studying the history of radio, and it's been a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Where is it right, you think, to pick this day as the birthday for radio?
I guess it depends on what you mean by the first radio broadcast. You know, at the very beginning, radio as we know it didn't exist at all. It was mostly telegraph. And when we think of Marconi, his invention was a way of sending telegraph signals by radio without wires, the wireless, so to speak. And that was demonstrated back in the 1870s and really developed very much in the 1880s and 90s. And the Marconi Company had a wonderful concept that has just recently re-emerged. I say wonderful simply because it inspires wonder that anyone could consider it. The Marconi Company said, look, we're not going to be selling radio equipment to people. We're going to sell them the right to use equipment. And they installed equipment on ships and sent along an operator and had shore stations themselves and charged people for the right to communicate. And you know what's kind of interesting about that is that the recording industry is these days moving in precisely the same direction. Mm-hmm. They are saying you don't buy a recording. You buy the right to use a recording in certain ways. And they'll sell you a DVD or a CD, which is programmed to be played a certain number of times or on a certain piece of equipment but not other equipment. So it's what goes around comes around, I guess.
Yeah. On that, at least it remains to be seen what people will put up with. My hope is, at least with some of these things, that that consumers will say, no, we're not going to play that way.
Yeah, you'd hope so. In any event, we really didn't get into the ability to transmit voice by radio until the very early 1900s. And Lee DeForest is the guy that should get the credit, I suppose. He invented a kind of tube which had a grid in it, which allowed the tube to amplify and also to detect. And it was that particular invention, the Audion, as it was then called, which allowed this kind of transmission to become feasible. And so it was in January of 1910 that there was a broadcast from the Met with much interference, and many people said that they could hear some of it. The problem was that the frequencies also were being used by Marconi's people to transmit telegrams and other such things. So it was a chancy thing. And besides that, there weren't any receivers out there. If you were going to have a receiver, you built it yourself. I guess what most people think of as the first broadcast didn't happen till much later than that. You recall that there were lots and lots of amateurs who started receiving and sending and having fun with radio in the period right after 1910. And all of this development stopped in 1914 due to the outbreak of World War I. We think of one of the dramatic events of radio as 1912, the sinking of the Titanic, and the Marconi operator David Sarnoff sitting in a little booth in New York getting lists of survivors and so on. But that wasn't really broadcasting as we know it. I think most people feel that the first really scheduled broadcast was on November 2nd, 1920. And on that date, the results of the Harding-Cox election, presidential election, were broadcast by KDKA in Pittsburgh, which had gotten its license only 3 days before. So there's a way to jump into history, is be the first broadcast. So in any event, you know, here we were listening to the election returns in 1920, and is that the first broadcast? Because by then, a lot of people had receiving equipment, which they had built themselves.
And at that point, you still would have to. You could not go down to some store someplace and buy a receiver that was already ready to go.
Well, you know, that's a really important point. Why do you suppose KDKA was begun? It was owned by the Westinghouse Corporation, who had an interest in selling people radios.
Oh, they figured they had to have something for them to listen to.
Sure. There's a closer at home example. By the 1920s, ready-made sets were coming on the market. They were still somewhat of a rarity, but they were moving along quite nicely. And many department stores decided that if they were going to sell radios, there had to be some programs out there, and so they started radio stations. In Chicago, there was one that was started by the world's largest store, Sears, and they chose for their call letters WLS for World's Largest Store. And there were many in many different parts of the country that did precisely the same thing.
Mm-hmm. This morning in this part of Focus, our guest is our own general manager, Don Mullally. We're talking a little bit about the early days of radio, and here we'll play you some examples of some commercials. As Don explained, that over time he's collected a lot of old radio programs and some commercials, and it's been a hobby of his for a long time now, and he brought along a few examples.
Well, you know, David, one of the questions that has been asked repeatedly, and we're going to come back to this a little later, I think, is who should pay for radio? And that is a question that we ask ourselves daily here at WILL. But it wasn't a foregone conclusion that radio would be largely commercial. There were several different options suggested. And in New York, there was a radio station owned by AT&T. And AT&T began to wonder how they could get a few bucks out of this thing. And they settled on the idea of the telephone model. You could pay to have messages broadcast. They called them toll broadcasts. And the first one was for a real estate development on Long Island. It was really quite low-key, more focused on the health benefits of not living in Manhattan than on the virtues of that particular real estate development. But sooner or later, things became a little more obvious, And so here is a commercial from the 1920s. You'll recognize this.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the bran. Won't you try Wheaties? For wheat is the best food of man. They're crispy and crunchy the whole year through. The kiddies never tire of them, and neither will you. So just buy Wheaties, the best breakfast food in the land.
You ready to buy some?
Oh, yeah. I want to go for lunch. I'm going to go right out and get some Wheaties.
That song for Wheaties was later adapted for the Jack Armstrong program, and with a much more up-tempo kind of thing, but the song survived for years and years and years.
We have a caller here, and I don't want to make them wait forever, but I think that in the way that the story has unfolded, this very question is very interesting. If you look at the experience of other countries, I think almost every other country, broadcasting was regarded as being something, at least something that the government was, if not interested in, should own and regulate, like the post office.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, it seems that almost from the very beginning, people looked at it completely differently and as an opportunity to make money.
There was a magazine called Radio Broadcasting that came out in the very early 1900s, 1920s. Now, just for the sake of context, WILL went on the air in 1922 using the call letters WRM. And in the magazine of 1922, they raised the question, who should pay for broadcasting? And they gave several suggestions and invited readers of the magazine. Now, remember that this was not a trade magazine at that point. This was a general interest magazine. People interested in radio, which everyone was. It was a miracle of the age. They invited the readers to write in. And here were the choices that they thought through. Set manufacturers or receiver sellers should pay, as in the department stores owning radio stations and so on. But everybody thought that once everybody had a radio, that issue would go away. Somebody suggested an endowment by public-spirited citizens, a la Andrew Carnegie, who went around the country building libraries. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me to have some potential. He felt that there was no sin in becoming rich. The sin was in dying rich. And to prevent himself from falling into that sin, he went around building libraries everywhere. Well, why not radio stations? Some people suggested municipal financing. And the city of New York decided that they were going to do it. They built WNYC back in the 1920s with much objection from commercial companies who thought the city, if it wanted to broadcast, should rent time on the commercial stations. Some people thought that the states should fund it. And in fact, that has turned out to be an important and continuing kind of thing because they funded it through their universities. And the great growth of that was not in the East or the West. It was here in the Midwest where state legislators decided that radio was of such a benefit to agriculture and to the development of culture and so on that they have for many years supported it. In fact, WILL was entirely supported by the University of Illinois until 1973. Someone suggested a common fund that everyone in the United States would donate to, and it would be somehow divided up among all of the stations, commercial and non-commercial and whatever. Although actually, at that point, commercial advertising was not being considered. It was sort of thought of as a dirty thing. You don't want to do that. Somebody suggested direct public support, which would buy you a seat at the invisible theater of radio. For $10, you would get an orchestra seat. For $5, a balcony seat, and so on. That never caught on until public broadcasting picked it up. And finally, it was suggested that there be a tax on receivers, as they have in England and have had since the 1920s. Mm-hmm. That didn't go anywhere either. The receiver manufacturers didn't like that, and neither did a number of conservative people in Congress. There was a style issue that came up very early. What should radio sound like? Is this... I told you that, you know, advertising was considered just a little bit sleazy. Mm-hmm. Should this be a cultural medium? Should this be something that isn't for everybody in the world? Or should this be something that has a common touch? I want you to listen to this announcer and catch the style of this commercial.
Inspired harmonies of the Moonlight Sonata set the stage for another concert of the world's most honored music, presented as a salute to Longines, the world's most honored watch. The Longines Symphonette, under the leadership of Michel Piastro, will play a program of the world's most honored music. These lovely melodies and Longines watches make a common appeal to cultured people the world over.
All right, you cultured people, do you feel honored? You've got a call, I think, David.
We had a caller. I want to make sure that we... No? Okay. Well, what I will do is I will tell people who are listening that calls are welcome. In fact, we had somebody, I think we kept him waiting a little bit too long, and perhaps he had something else to do with his life. But if people want to call in, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455.
You know, David, one of the things that we know about radio is that it very early became a medium for news. And some of the newscasters of that time were a little strange, but I've got a cut of one here. I don't understand the mix of the newscaster and the product. That befuddles me completely. They just don't seem to go together. But let me give you three short examples of different kinds of products and the kinds of sponsors they had.
Walter Winchell's famous column appears in the New York Daily Mirror and other newspapers from New York to Honolulu. He's here with flash news, odd news, exclusive news. We have a Thanksgiving treat for you tonight. Miss Alma Archer is here in our Jergens studio and will speak to you later. Alma Archer is an expert on smartness and beauty, and she believes that the care of her hands is a duty for every woman. And now to the editorial room of the Jergens Journal and Walter Winchell.
Good evening, Mr. and Mr. North American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press. Flash. Juarez, Mexico. Betty Lawford, who takes a bath before... And that, ladies and gentlemen, winds up another Jergens Journal until next Sunday night at the very same time. Until then, and with lotions of love, I remain your New York correspondent, Walter Winchell, who thinks every American has at least one thing to be thankful for on Thursday next. Thankful that we still salute a flag and not a shirt. Good night.
Seeing is believing. See an Oxydol wash. See how Oxydol washes clothes white for life. Oxydol's own Ma Perkins. Visit any part of the country today and you'll hear amazing but true stories of the great new Oxydol. This new kind of Oxydol changed.
J-E-L-L-O!
The Jell-O program brought to you by Jell-O and Jell-O Pudding, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Dennis Day, Rochester, and yours truly, Don Wilson. The orchestra opens the program with I Am an American.
You notice how the name of the commercial sponsor is intertwined with the program. I mean, that was the Jell-O program with Jack Benny. Today we're going to hear probably a few commercials that for products that don't exist anymore, and even some commercials that are prohibited for broadcast on the radio.
Well, you should shoo the children out of the room. Well, you know, this just makes me think about a recent story that has been in media about television and about the fact that television advertisers know that audiences are tuning out the commercials. They tape stuff. We go through the commercials. We have mute buttons on our television sets. When basically when the commercial comes, we find something else to do. And someone now has come up with this idea of trying to embed the commercial into the program. So presumably, you know, that means if it's a sitcom, people will walk down the street and walk in front of an enormous Pepsi sign or something, you know, something that that makes it impossible essentially for people to avoid the commercial.
Yes, there's no question of that. I want to play you a commercial, David, that is for a product that still exists, but its character has changed. Now, you remember the cola wars of the 50s? Well, think about them, how they might have worked out in the 30s. Coca-Cola was the dominant beverage, and it came in a 6-ounce bottle. Pepsi-Cola had to find some way of beating Coke, and they did it by charging the same price that Coke did, which was a nickel, and giving you twice as much in the bottle, 12 ounces.
Pepsi-Cola, it's the spot. 12 ounces, that's a lot. Twice as much for a nickel, too. Pepsi-Cola is a drink for you. Nickel, 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 trickle, trickle, nickel, 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 trickle, 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 nickel, 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 trickle, trickle.
I love that one.
Nickel, nickel, trickle, trickle.
Yeah. That was from the 1930s. We're going to hear another one a little bit later from the 60s and 70s, and you'll see how the appeal has changed.
Mm-hmm. That's if they could sell you 12 ounces for a nickel, that probably meant it cost them 2 cents to produce the product,
yeah.
Maybe a penny.
Mm-hmm. And there was a deposit on the bottle. Well, one of my favorite notions about radio is that it's a kind of audio archaeology. Mm-hmm. If you listen to radio of the time, you can tell what the world was like in some ways. For example, today smoking is considered a serious problem, and we discourage it. It was encouraged wildly on radio, lots of cigarette commercials. What does a railroad train sound like today? Well, it's kind of a diesel with a horn, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do people shave with? Electric razors or something that comes out of a can? Not in those days. Let's listen to a guy named Norman Brokenshire, who was a pretty famous announcer in those days, and his introduction to a very famous headache remedy.
Shaving cream supreme
leaves your face so smooth and clean.
C-R-E-S-T-A. B-L-A-N-C-A. Cresta. Blanca. Cresta Blanca.
Rinso white and Rinso bright.
L-A-V-A. Well, if that doesn't stir old memories, huh?
A little before my time.
Oh, my. There were two products that were always advertised together, and I've managed to find an example of them not being together. One of them was Ipana for the smile of beauty and Cell Hepatica for the smile of health. A rather ghastly-tasting laxative, I think. But how do you make a laxative sound like fun? That is the question.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. someone once said that the world stands aside to make way for the man who knows where he's going. And so tonight it gives me great pleasure to make way for a man who knows what he's talking about. Harry Von Zell.
Don't ever neglect a cold. At the very first sign of a cold, get after it immediately with the faster help of what's the name?
Fred Allen, remember?
No. The name of the... I'm awfully sorry, that eagle has upset me. I can't remember the name of what it is that helps fight colds faster. It slipped my mind.
Well, it'll come to you. Go ahead, Harry.
Well, yes, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, this famous product acts very quickly, yet it's exceptionally gentle. And since the progress of a cold is very fast, the greater speed of what it is I'm talking about is especially important in fighting your cold. And that's not all. The name will come to me in a minute. It also helps nature counteract the acidity that so often accompanies a cold. And, ladies and gentlemen, you can check these facts with your own doctor.
You'd better check the name, too, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, Fred, you know what I'm talking about,
Why,
don't you?
Why, certainly, Harry. You're talking about America's outstanding saline laxative.
That's it, Fred. And the name is...
The name is, so many physicians recommend it.
Yes. And it helps fight colds faster. But what is the name?
Well, here's a pretty to-do. Wait, Harry. There must be somebody around here who knows. If there is, will you please tell us confidentially?
Sal Hepatica!
That's it, Sal Hepatica. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
I seem to fail to see the association between colds and constipation, but perhaps there
is. That has
is
nothing
one.
To do with anything.
Oh, I see.
What you want to do is sell Sal Hepatica, I suppose. You know, the interesting thing about old radio commercials is that often they are associated so well in people's minds that 30, 40 years later, they still remember the jingles, the songs, the commercials, the programs. And I'm willing to bet that there are people out there in today's radio audience listening to this program who remember a lot of these commercials that we've played and a lot of the programs.
Sure.
I want to give you a really quick tour of a couple of programs for some products that don't exist anymore and some that do, and one that did a transition to radio. First of all, do you remember the Jell-O jingle? Have you got that in your mind?
The Jell-O jingle?
And now the Jell-O family presents...
Henry! Henry Aldrich!
Coming, Mother.
Yes, it's the Aldrich family, based on characters originated by Clifford Goldsmith and starring Ezra Stone as Henry with Jackie Kelk as Homer. And yes, it's the Jell-O family. Time to play Truth or Consequences. Yes, Truth or Consequences, the show that does everything on the air, brought to you by Dove, the soap that does everything in your watch. And here he is, left over from the Halloween Hobgoblins, your aren't we devils man, Ralph Truth or Consequences Edwards.
Say, are you cooking with Crisco? It's digestible. All vegetable. Yes, it's Crisco's Young Dr. Malone.
America's finest silver plate is 1847 Rogers Brothers. From Hollywood, International Silver Company, creators of 1847 Rogers Brothers Silver Plate, presents The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, starring America's favorite young couple, Ozzie Nelson and Harriet Hilliard.
All right. Tell me, David, do you remember where Ozzie and Harriet lived?
No, I can't.
Can you come up with their street address, maybe?
No. The only thing that I do recall is that Ozzy, you really didn't know what he did for a living, if anything. Did he actually go off to work and then come back, or did he not even bother to do that?
I think he did. The reason I asked you if you knew the street address, if you knew the sponsor, you knew the street address. They lived at 1847 Rogers Road. Isn't that awful? Working it into the commercial and everything like that. One of the remarkable, we were talking about Sal Hepatica, the laxative. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting laxative quiz show combinations was one that was sponsored by Phenamint, the chewing gum laxative. And they began the program with, Phenamint brings you Double or Nothing, which I always thought was just a marvelous title for their program. One of the beloved ones came out of Chicago for many, many years. And it was Fibber McGee and Molly, but they were sponsored by the Johnson's Wax Corporation. And somehow they had to work this commercial into the program, which was very typical of the time. They had an announcer by the name of Harlow Wilcox, who ultimately became known as Waxy Wilcox, who would periodically drop in on Fibber McGee and Molly.
Look, dearie, now, this is a...
Hello, Molly. Hi, pal.
Hello, Mr. Wilcox. Come on in.
Sit down, Junior, but don't talk. I'm creating. What's he creating, Molly, besides the funny noise on that paper spoiler?
Well, he's writing the story of the invention of the typewriter, Mr. Wilcox. His version of it, at least.
Really? Well, look, pal, I used to do a little writing. Let me give you a tip, will you?
He'll welcome it, won't you, dearie?
No, but I'll be polite about it. Okay, Junior, unburden yourself. I ain't heard anything about you writing the great American novel, but go ahead. Tell the author how to write.
Well, I was just going to suggest that you keep it simple. You see, when I first started writing advertising for Johnson's Paste Wax, I used to say, Johnson's Paste Wax will render your possessions invulnerable to abrasions, impregnable to friction, attrition, and confrication. Stuff like that.
I think that's beautiful writing.
Personally, I don't care.
I used to say things like, Johnson's Paste Wax inevitably imparts a coruscating, scintillating fulguration to one's floors, furniture, and woodwork, which endows the domicile with joviality and vivacity and attracts the spirit of euphrosyne to the dwellers therein.
You don't say.
I almost didn't.
You keep writing like that, Junior, and they'll revoke your poetic license.
I bet that would have sold a lot of Johnson's Paste Wax, though, if anybody knew what you meant.
Well, that's what the company said. They said, look, kid, let's just keep it simple. Just tell them that Johnson's Paste Wax will give floors, furniture, and woodwork a soft, gleaming luster that shines with the happy look of a well-loved home. That will give a new protection and beauty that time and age can't.
Hey, look. Waxy.
Yes, pal. Hey, look, I'd like to stay and criticize your story, but I've got to run along.
And that's how it was done, how you work the commercial into the program. You just have the announcer visit.
Just drop by.
Yeah. Right. Waxy Wilcox.
Let me, we've been talking here for a while. I think maybe I should just, for people who are listening, I better reintroduce and just remind people that the guest this morning is Don Mullally. He's our own general manager for WYLAM, FM, and TV. And somebody who has been very interested in the history of radio broadcasting for a long time, and kind of as a hobby, he has over the years collected a lot of old radio programs. And as I said at the beginning of the program, a long time ago, folks may remember that he actually had a show here on WYLL, a regular program where he would play old radio. And I know a lot of people remember that and really enjoy the show. This we picked this day to talk a little bit about radio just because this is the day in 1910 when Lee DeForest did what a lot of people think of as kind of the first radio broadcast. Maybe it wasn't heard by a lot of people. It wasn't the first regularly scheduled broadcast, but it's as good a hook as any to hang the discussion on. And we thought, well, we'll talk a little bit about early radio. And Don, for fun, brought along a number of clips from old radio commercials. Starting the very first one was from the 20s, and we have been moving along here in time. And I think that the last few date from the decade of the 1940s.
Right. We're still in the 40s. Okay. Tell me, David, what do you do when you have a cold?
I take a stiff brandy and go to bed.
Wrong answer. You go out and buy some cigarettes immediately.
Oh, I forgot about the health-giving properties of tobacco. Yeah.
Yes, a laxative first and then the cigarettes.
Then cigarettes.
I don't have enough trouble. Phil has to call up. I wish the doctor would get here. I feel awful. Oh, there it goes again. I can't move. Answer that, will you, Mary?
Oh, all right, all right. Don't be so grouchy.
Don't be so grouchy.
Hello?
Hello, Mary. This is Don. How's Jack feeling?
Oh, he acts like he's the only one in the world who has a cold. It's like a big baby.
Well, maybe he's a lot worse than you think. Gesundheit, Mary.
That was Jack.
Oh, well, let me speak to him.
Here, Jack.
Hello, Don. What do you want?
Gesundheit, and I'll put Mary back on.
Never mind, Mary. What do you want?
Well, the Sportsman Quartet is over here at my house.
Well, why aren't they over here? I want to hear the song they're going to do on our program Sunday.
Oh, they can't take a chance coming to your house, Jack. After all, they're singers. They might catch your cold.
Cold or no cold, they're supposed to come over here and rehearse the number. A lot they think of my program.
Now, wait a minute, Jack. You're taking the wrong attitude.
What?
As soon as the boys heard about your cold, they were very concerned, and they've got some good advice for you.
Advice?
Yeah, here, I'll put them on the phone.
Look, boys, when I've got a cold, I don't need any advice.
Give it to him, boys!
Look, Don, I don't need any advice.
Button up your overcoat when the wind is free. Take good care of yourself. Careful, Mr. B.
Careful.
Eat an apple every day. Go to bed by 3. Take good care of yourself. Passing NBC. Be careful in the freeze. Ooh. Watch it, please, ooh, or you'll sneeze, ooh. You'll get a cold and ruin your program.
Look, I've got a cold.
Really
I don't have to get
bad.
One now.
Call a doctor, do. Take good care of yourself, cause we all love you. When you're buying cigarettes, buy the brand you like. Take good care of yourself, smoke a Lucky Strike. When you're driving in a car, or you're on a hike, take good care of yourself, smoke a Lucky Strike.
If I may have my say,
please do.
Don't delay.
What's new?
Start today.
Ooh, light up a Lucky and you'll enjoy it. Men who know tobacco best, smoke the best you see. Round burn, fully packed, Bellas and FP. M-M-M-M-T.
So round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw.
Was that the brand recommended by 4 out of 5 doctors?
No, that was Camel's, believe it or
oh,
not.
Oh, okay. I knew there was some brand. Now, that was.
Camels were absolutely the strongest, most potent cigarettes, and 9 out of 10 New York doctors believe that, et cetera. Even
remarkable.
Opera singers. I have a commercial in which opera singers were recommending
endorsing
in cigarettes.
Cigarettes. All right. Hey, let's talk with a caller here. We have someone in Pena on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was born in 1933, and our whole family, including my grandparents, were very devoted to radio, and all of your programs you're running today, the ads and all that are very familiar, were very familiar to all of us. I also want to mention the use of the Hammond organ was used quite a bit for the themes, and the theme songs themselves were very famous. For example, I remember the Lone Ranger always had, went dum, 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 dum.
Yes, the William Tell Overture.
William Tell Overture. And many of the stories were written by Frank and Ann Hummert, I remember. They would speak of the story by Frank and Ann Hummert. And,
they actually ran what was sort of a radio factory. They turned out maybe half a dozen or a dozen different programs every day, 15-minute programs every single day from Chicago.
From Chicago. Well, I want to mention, too, during the dark days of World War II, the radio was a great comfort to all of us, and the news, all of the news commentators you mentioned were our favorites, and the radio was kind of our connection with the outside world. We were a little more isolated in those days, and before television, we never heard of television. And after supper, we would all gather around and listen to old Lux Radio Theater and all of those. Every day had its certain programs and stories, even Sunday. On Sunday was The Shadow, I remember. And, we were very high fans of the radio. We had great, large console radios in those days. And, like I say, we never heard of television. And, I was always a radio fan, and I still am. And I just wanted to... Oh, there was one more thing I wanted to mention was... In cigarettes, I remember this call for Philip Morris was a big thing in those days. Philip Morris cigarettes.
That was Johnny the Bellboy was calling for Philip Morris.
Yes, and those things just bring back many fond memories. I'm about 70 years old, and those are just very marvelous. We used to come home at noon, my dad included, would come home from work, and we'd listen to Ma Perkins. From Oxydol.
Yep, Oxydol's own Ma Perkins.
And the theme songs were very connected with the, and the, as you say, to the product, was very connected with the story and the program. And we liked the commercials. It was part of our entertainment in those days.
Well, did you smoke, by the way?
Not in those days. I was too young. I did later.
Mm-hmm. Do you think radio advertising influenced your decision to smoke?
No, I just kind of, when I was a kid, you know, kids weren't supposed to smoke in those days. And, it probably, underneath it all, it may have a little bit, but when I started smoking, I smoked Pall Mall, which was...
Famous cigarettes, and they are mild.
Yes. But I don't remember Pall Mall in the early days, but I remember all the neighbors smoked. Like you say, some of those cigarettes were very strong, and they they didn't have any filters.
That's right.
In those early days. And during the war, our neighbor lady would roll cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And one day she gave my brother and I just some raw tobacco, and she made us chew it, and of course we spit it out, and it made us sick, and she said, "Now that should teach you never to smoke." So we didn't till after I got out of high school, and then I quit.
Well, thanks for sharing your memories with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When we were talking about cigarettes here, we've got... a series of three commercials that I want to put together just to show how a commercial develops over time. These are all for the same product from 1950s.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston gives you real flavorful, rich tobacco flavor. Winston's easy drawing too. The filter lets the flavor through. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston gives you real flavorful, rich tobacco flavor. Winston's easy drawing to. The filter lets the flavor through. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
familiar theme. See if you recognize it. That's right. Winston tastes good, like a cigarette should.
Well, I recognize it after hearing...
After having heard it a few times.
Three or four of those, yeah. We have a caller?
We're also getting real short on time. I guess we can try to take the caller here. Winnebago, line number four.
Good morning.
Yes.
My memory was jogged, and you didn't mention how that first radio program by Lee DeForest was from the Illinois Institute of Technology, which at that time was the Armour Institute. Right at Federal and 33rd Street in Chicago.
Chicago certainly was a hub of early radio broadcasting.
Yeah, I found he broadcast, his station was in the main building, but years ago we found down in the basement of Chapin Hall across the street the laboratory. With a whole bunch of electrical instruments, the darndest things you ever saw. And now the building was torn down and they put up a library on top of it. But he had been a instructor at the Armour Institute and was... That was probably a bigger thing than he did than actually fiddling with the vacuum tube.
My apologies to the caller. I'm simply going to have to jump in because we're going to have to wrap up. We've got our noontime broadcast of the governor's inauguration, so I think we better move it along. I think maybe what we should do is say, well, we'll just sort of put the conversation on hold. How about you come back on another day? We can talk some more.
Sure can.
Our guest this morning, our general manager, Don Mullally, talking a little bit about the beginnings of radio. We'll have some more conversations. I think we'll come back and we'll do it again. But for the moment, we'll have to stop.